Welcome to Serve and Volley, the tennis podcast for people who like arguments. I'm Nick.
I'm Pavel.
So yes, welcome back to Serve and Volley. We're delighted that you've chosen to join us in this period where you have so many other options for things to do. Pavel, are you well?
I'm healthy. I've got hay fever.
I'm sad that you're not in my living room as you normally are when we record this.
Well, I'm in my study, close enough.
We should start by contextualizing this a bit because obviously I'm in the Midlands and you're in Germany and, you know, life is not as it was. I mean, we're not going to be revealing anything new to our listeners by saying that the coronavirus has changed things, but it has changed the tennis calendar and I don't know what in the foreseeable future it's going to look like.
Well, I like to think of us as being ahead of the curve because we stopped doing serve and volley and then the whole of the tennis world stopped. So, you know, it wasn't so much that we're taking an unplanned hiatus as we were just anticipating the disruption to come.
If anything, we have actually come back now that there is no tennis and we were away whilst there was tennis. So we are very avant-garde.
Yeah.
We should now be going into the clay court season, enjoying skidding on the red mud of Monte Carlo, and then looking ahead to the French Open. But the French Open will now be happening, if it happens at all, in September.
Yeah, which was a controversial decision.
You'd prefer it not to happen at all?
Well, no, I mean, I guess if it does go ahead, it's better to have a Grand Slam tournament instead of not having one. But I do think that Wimbledon have done the more kind of honourable thing and just said, look, this is not an option at the moment.
Well,
we'll see in 2021.
You call it honourable, and I'm not saying it's not honourable, but they also have the, you know, can they do Wimbledon in the autumn? I mean, in this country, I just don't think you could do a grass court tournament in other than any time other than peak summer. In a way, the French have a slightly bigger window of play, but I don't think they can't presumably do it much after September. I just think Wimbledon had no window in which to move the tournament into.
Wasn't Court 1 getting a roof, though, if you'd had...
Brilliant. I cannot imagine the congestion of trying to do an entire Grand Slam tournament on two courts.
Yeah, but... You know, it's better than the French, which only just got its roof.
What are they going to do about ranking points from those tournaments?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. I mean, I think actually that for me is less of an issue because ultimately the ranking point you have from 12 months ago, yeah, it's unfair if you, quote unquote, don't get a chance to defend them. But ultimately, does it really matter where those points were picked up? I think what matters in the end is how many points you pick up in a certain season out of how many were available. And so that's the real competition. I think of the kind of the race to London or race to Turin, as it will eventually be known, as the kind of almost more significant metric than the 12-month metric because players can fall off so much and so quickly.
Well, you tell that to someone who had a surprise run at last year's Wimbledon. I can't even remember who won last year's Wimbledon. It was
Roberto Bautista Agut had a very surprising
run. You tell that to Roberto Bautista Agut and his family and loved ones that you're taking the food off their table. Anyway, in the absence of live tennis to talk about, we decided we'd come back and do a special kind of series of Serve and Volley where we look at and debate some of the biggest questions in the world of tennis, starting with perhaps the biggest.
Yeah, why not? Go in the deep end. And this is obviously a question that's been debated by almost every single tennis fan out there.
I have never discussed this in public before.
Well, now I'm glad I'm, you know, taking your... goat debate virginity, as it were. We're talking, I think, specifically... Well, actually, not necessarily. We're talking about men's tennis. Usually when people have this goat debate, it's about the obvious Federer versus Nadal versus Djokovic. This debate kind of emerged over the course of the last decade.
Let's have a sort of gender-ambiguous goat. I mean, I don't see why... You know, it's the goat of all time. Wait, no, it's not the goat of all time. It's the...
It's just the greatest of all time.
It's not the gamote.
That's true. No, I mean, there is also a couple of sub-debates to be had, which is the whole kind of Serena versus Steffi Graf versus Margaret.
Yeah, we can get onto that, Pavel.
And then also the comparing players across the gender divide and saying, is it fair to call Serena the greatest player of all time rather than the greatest women's tennis player of all time? But I think we can start with the men and then move on from there.
Okay, let's start with the men. And I always like to start by kind of asking you to do a bit of a tennis history lesson for me, because for me, tennis sort of begins. And I've always said that I'm not a great sporting historian. I watch a lot of sport in the moment, but I don't agonize about it before. And I can remember watching for the sort of a bit of the Agassi-Sampras era. But really, tennis for me starts with Federer. Go on, put it in the context of the previous 50 years of tennis before that.
Yeah, that's a good way to start. I guess Laver, Rod Laver, is always considered to be one of the greats of all time, if not the greatest. Obviously, it's very difficult to compare players across eras, given the changes in, you know, the rackets and the training and so on. But Laver won the calendar year Grand Slam twice, once in the amateur era, once in the open / professional era. He won 11 Grand Slam singles titles. He also won a load of Grand Slam doubles and mixed doubles titles. He won the Davis Cup numerous times. And then he won the professional majors because he went pro before the tours merged. So it's kind of hard to compare it, but I guess in modern terms, you could say that he was actually somewhat close to, you know, Nadal's or Djokovic's slam count. So he's obviously kind of the overwhelming pre-Borg number one. Then Bjorn Borg comes along, retires at 26, but manages to win Wimbledon about 5-6 times and the French about 5-6 times. So makes a very strong claim for definitely being the best player of that era. Because he retired early, it's hard to say whether he would have then gone on to have Sampras numbers or even Federer numbers. But clearly there were some mental issues there. But again, he will be considered one of the top players of all time. So the other big players in that era were McEnroe and Connors. But I think apart from Connors' longevity and McEnroe's kind of force of personality and serve, they're considered to be maybe a level slightly below Borg. And then, which basically leads us into the 80s and everyone's favorite, Ivan Lendl emerges, probably one of the best of all time on clay, certainly. Also reached like 8 straight US Open finals in a row or something like that. Which then leads us to, you know, Willander and Edberg, who are kind of top 10, top 15 of all time. And then Agassi and Sampras emerged, which kind of brings us up to date. The modern era, because Federer emerged by beating Sampras in Wimbledon and then also faced Agassi in the US Open final.
What about some of the even older ones like Don Budge and Bill Tilden and Ken Rosewall? And I have a list in front of me.
Well, Rosewall and Laver are basically contemporaries, aren't they? Rosewall also had like incredible longevity. I think he was still playing at a high level until he was like in his early 40s. But I think he was always seen as kind of the second best Australian and the second best player in the world at that time to Laver. And I can't really tell you much before the Open era, because obviously then the debate is, well, is it better to win Wimbledon or would the professionals have beaten those amateurs, which is, you know, quite likely. There was the kind of cricket, kind of fair disparity, you know, these players aren't training. How dare they? They should just walk out there in all whites and smack everyone.
So it brings us sort of into the Federer, Djokovic, Nadal era, the big three era. And I guess those three are sort of unavoidable names in this debate. And to be honest, we're probably, you know, that sort of potted history is probably teaching our listeners to suck eggs slightly. But it's sort of those three plus, let's say, Laver, Sampras, Borg. You know, that those are the kind of the contenders, really, on the men's side, would you say?
Yeah.
Anyone else you want to make a pitch for, maybe to make it up to Roberto Bautista Agut for what you earlier said?
I think Roberto Bautista Agut is the best current Spanish player with three names.
Gosh, was it Alberto Corona Busta?
Pablo Corona Busta. And Albert Ramos Vinolas. I definitely think Roberto Bautista Agut is the best of the three. I don't know what the acronym for that would be, though, or the initialism. Yeah, so... No, I think that's the top six. I think Agassi is probably just after those because of his versatility across all surfaces in an era where that was much less common than it is now.
Yeah, well, you're a bit of a wonk. So tell me, kind of, I think you would be inclined to kind of crunch the data on this in purely terms of kind of what they've achieved in tournament wins, Grand Slam wins, you know, across all the Grand Slams and across Davis Cup and Olympics too. Is it just, you know, Federer is still the outstanding candidate, or is his lack of he lacks an Olympic gold medal? No, is that a big deal?
Yeah, I mean, Federer has a doubles Olympic gold, and Djokovic doesn't have an Olympic gold either.
Nadal does have a singles Olympic gold.
He does, yeah. Not to take anything away from that, but the person that won the Olympics gold before that was Nicolas Massu, and nobody's gonna list him as one of the contenders for even the best Chilean player.
Who is the best Chilean player? Fernando Gonzalez?
Or Marcelo Rios. I mean, he reached number one, right? Anyway, I think we're getting distracted here. So, no, I think, obviously, to kind of foreground this, I do think Federer is the greatest player of all time, but I don't think it's...
Oh, spoiler alert, Pavel.
Well, no, I think it's the gap has narrowed a lot in recent years, and there's enough data out there so that if you kind of have a specific slant and you want to prove that Nadal is greater, then there are certain stats you can point to, as in, you know, Nadal has been let down a lot by injuries, he's much more efficient when he does play, he has a better head-to-head, he has the Olympic gold. I'm sure there's a couple more that I'm forgetting. There's also the kind of famous weak era argument, which Nadal fans used to use when Federer had like a solid Grand Slam lead, but Nadal had the head-to-head lead, saying, oh, well, you know, Federer was born a few years later, he wouldn't be where he is now. Which, you know, I mean, that's just conjecture. And
surely
I think
an even more compelling argument for Djokovic, and I guess in that he only exists in an era where Federer and Nadal are, you know, Grand Slam pack men gobbling it up. There's no time when Djokovic just has one leading competitor, whereas Nadal, I guess, because he broke out a bit younger, did have a couple of years where it was just him and Federer tossing it between them.
Yeah, I think that's also kind of where that argument died out, is because, you know, Federer is still playing at a top, you know, five level in the world, certainly at the age of almost 40, when a whole generation's kind of come and gone. So he's kind of, because of his longevity, he's kind of proven that he can play across eras and he can adapt. And then Djokovic, also the kind of the whole peculiarity of the lost gen, and also, you know, the next gen is kind of breaking through, but still, I think most would agree, be below where they should be. So then it kind of takes away from that argument, because Federer had the weak era at the start of his career, so the argument goes, but then Nadal and Djokovic benefited from, you know, the lack of generational talents coming through after them. So that kind of balances out, which then leaves Federer on 20 slams, Nadal 19, and Djokovic is currently on 17, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, and then Nadal and Djokovic have more Masters titles. Nadal doesn't have a Tour Finals title, whereas Federer and Djokovic have like five or six apiece. So that gives the two of them the edge, which kind of...
Yeah. I've got to say, like, Masters, Tour Finals, Boar Finals. I mean, like, you know, no one's going to remember Nikolai Davidenko for winning the Tour Finals in, you know, 20 years' time, or Dimitrov or whatever. I mean, the reality is these are great in terms of your ranking points and pushing you towards that number one, which is obviously a historic place to be. And it's also good in terms of prize money. But these are not, like, lasting achievements. The only things that people... you know, even bring into the debate, you know, we're not interested in anything about Rod Laver's career other than those Grand Slam and Pro Slam titles. And so I think that, like, if you're going to fairly contextualize the big three in a historic sense, you have to just sort of broadly discount all the stuff that's going to be kind of the shrapnel of history, like, you know, Masters titles. And just
you could kind of say the same thing about the Olympic gold. Obviously, Olympic gold is much rarer than the other ones because it only happens every 4 years. But, you know, Murray has won two. But he's still considered well below the other three.
But Pavel, I think there's an argument to say that in 20 years' time, beyond the British fetishization of Andy Murray, he'll be looked back at mainly for those two Olympic gold medals and not for his three Grand Slams. So I mean, that's what I think the Olympic gold medal has a much greater prominence than any sort of Masters or Tour Finals title, also because they're rarer.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair, but I think you kind of hit the right note earlier when you said that it kind of pushes you towards number one. So Federer Djokovic winning six apiece has obviously helped them in terms of ranking points and prize money, which is also and sometimes used as a kind of tiebreaker because it's sort of a proxy for the importance of the tournaments you're winning and how many tournaments you're winning. Although again, because Federer is older, the prize money is actually inflated quite a bit since he started winning these big titles. But yeah, so Federer and Djokovic are ahead of Nadal in terms of being number one. But like you said, Nadal kind of was in the middle between the two of them. So never had a chance to just kind of play in his own era, as it were.
I also want to introduce as a complicating factor my belief that the Australian Open should count for less than the other three Grand Slams.
I mean, I think Nadal could push you right now.
I have a pretty strict hierarchy of Grand Slams. And I think it's maybe not said often enough that the Australian Open isn't really a proper Grand Slam and should be like a sort of 1200, I think.
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously nonsense. The Australian Open...
In what other sport is Australia, you know, one of the four... I mean, I don't know. It's just so boring. It's also just... It's just another hardcore surface in a country where there are sort of no other, you know, major sporting events.
The Ashes takes place there every other... whatever.
Yeah.
I think Australian Open has a very strong feel usually because everyone's kind of fresh, rested from the off season, the fewer injuries. And in recent years, it has had the faster surface than US Open. And I think arguably kind of the better narratives. Certainly the Federer 2017 Australian Open run, I think, is one of the most memorable recent majors. None of the US Opens can really measure up to that. But I think, yeah, I think that's, you know, they're all worth the same amount. You might prefer one over the other.
No, I don't. It's not that I prefer one of the, I think that winning Wimbledon is a more historically important thing to do than winning the Australian Open. And I don't care that they're all technically worth the same. I think we all know that, you know, if you've won one Grand Slam and it's the Australian Open, nobody's going to give a shit in 20 years.
Yeah. Although, are people going to give a shit about Marin Cilic in 20 years?
No. I think the US Open is the second least important one.
Because there's two hard court slams to the kind of counter.
Because there are two hard court slams and because they play music at the intervals and they have no sense of history.
Okay, yeah. I guess the kind of counterpoint to that is that you can just surfboard your way to the Wimbledon title, like Ivanišević and Krajicek did, in a way that's... Well, actually, Roddick never managed to do it. But both...
Yeah, I mean, the number of people who have surfboarded their way to the Wimbledon title is not high enough for me to really think that, you know, the surfboards are having a field day there, so...
Okay, so basically, everyone's kind of on equal-ish slam counts, equal-ish tournament counts, except Federer has more, but he's also older, so the other two guys will catch up a bit. And I think ultimately it will just come down to your personal preference. And for me, Federer is by far the best of the three to watch play. So even if Nadal were to overtake him on a slam count, which is not that unlikely, especially if Wimbledon isn't played this year, but the French Open is, I still think Federer is, on balance, a more enjoyable, more impressive player to watch. And I think there is a certain je ne sais quoi when it comes to the GOAT kind of discussion when people talk about Michael Jordan versus LeBron. Or people talk about Messi versus Ronaldo. Like, you can crunch the stats, but it will come down to your gut feeling a bit as well. And I think, obviously, Nadal and Djokovic are close enough so that I can't just say, oh, yeah, Federer is far and away the best. He's just kind of my top player. But I can definitely figure out an argument for either of the other two, even though I enjoy them.
I think what Federer has in his advantage is, you know, a consistency across the surfaces that Nadal really... You know, outside of the French Open, you know, he's won the Australian Open once and Wimbledon twice. And, you know, Federer, I guess, has only won the French Open once. But across that, he's really been dominant at all the Grand Slams. Djokovic, again, has been most profitable down in Australia at the tournament that I don't think is a real tournament. So that's kind of another reason why, even though I'm sort of naturally, I butt up against the Federer GOAT argument because, you know, so many insipid Arsenal fans like yourself tend to present it, and people who sort of have this weirdly fetishized view of Federer.
Why? What's the parallel between Arsenal and Federer?
I don't know. There's something about, like, the love of, you know, there was this...
It's like Wenger Ball.
The Arsenals, yeah, it's a bit like Wenger Ball, like the desire to walk it into the net and, you know, like, oh, it's so pretty. This pretty ineffective football was what Arsenal fans really loved, because for a while they did pretty and effective football, and then they just went off the boil. Anyway, with Federer, so I see a sort of parallel there, but I do think that it's kind of hard to, certainly if I'm pushed into a corner and said Federer, Nadal, Djokovic, who's the greatest of all time out of those, I would say Federer, and I cannot present a good argument for anyone historically, because I haven't watched, you know, I haven't watched Rod Laver play tennis. I don't think ever.
I think
I'm going to choose Federer over Sampras.
I don't think there's any argument against that. I mean, Federer's won six more majors and had to compete with two of the other greatest players of all time, and, you know, was also fantastic on clay, which Sampras never was. But yeah, I think Federer is the most enjoyable one to see play. He has the longevity, he has the titles, and for now he also has the slam count and the weeks at number one. He might get overtaken, but I think most tennis fans do appreciate kind of the aesthetic side of the game. And even though Djokovic and Nadal have their fair share of fans, I think the kind of the average non-tennis watcher is much more likely to prefer Federer. So that kind of gives them the edge. What about the women?
Well, I think that the women is maybe a more clear-cut case. Certainly, if you sort of take doubles out of the equation, which I think we sort of are doing.
Yeah, you mean because Navratilova has won, like...
Yeah, I think you could make an argument for Navratilova in terms of titles and in terms of longevity and sort of, you know, consistency. But I think probably Serena Williams, other than that, is an obvious answer to this question.
Is there a kind of... I mean, obviously, if we really wanted to kind of go on and on a bit while tennis is absent, we could rehash the kind of Monica Seles stabbing. But generally, couldn't you kind of make an argument that Graf played in a stronger era than Serena? Serena has kind of benefited from the same vacuum that people argued that Fed benefited from, but for much, much longer. The WTA has been such a mess for the last 10 years, if not longer. There hasn't been really any players to compete with her after Justine Henin and Kim Clijsters retired for, you know, the second time.
Yeah, but I mean, it's interesting that people always... I mean, Serena has won, what, one more Grand Slam than Steffi Graf won?
Yeah.
And yet, I feel like people don't contest the idea that Serena Williams is a better tennis player than Steffi Graf.
Yeah, I mean, she's... What about the Olympics? She's won three doubles, one singles, Serena.
Yeah, I mean, Steffi Graf also won an Olympic singles
Oh, medal. Yeah, she won all four plus the Olympics in the same year. Yeah, she's got a gold in singles, a silver in singles, and a bronze in doubles. So, yeah.
I ask that as a sincere question. Why do we sort of erase Steffi Graf? Because Steffi Graf and Serena Williams are very close in terms of the titles won and the sort of their, what their career achievements are. But I just feel like, is it that we sort of have been spent the last couple of years just sort of expecting Serena to just keep picking up more titles and really stretch a lead over Steffi Graf in a way that she hasn't, for some reason that it's almost seems psychological at this point, hasn't done?
Yeah, I think part of it is recency bias. Part of it that Steffi Graf never had the longevity that Serena had. She won her last title when she was just before she turned 30, her last major title, I mean. Whereas, you know, Serena is still at this incredibly high level, even now, even though she'd lost four major finals in a row. You know, just reaching four major finals in over six tournaments is insane, right? So I think the fact that Serena is still kind of the player to beat, and the fact that many people can't really remember watching Steffi Graf play, even though it wasn't, you know, crazy long time ago, but you know, it's still 20 years since she retired, give or take. And if you watch these like old grainy clips, they just kind of look like people almost playing a different sport, so much slower, so much less athletic. I think the kind of counter argument to what I just said before about Serena living in this vacuum is that the general quality of tennis has improved a lot for both men and women. I actually think that, like, you know, it might be the poly strings, but it's also just to do with the fact that people kind of train a lot harder and a lot smarter. And Serena would just, I think, power Steffi off the court in the same way that Federer or Djokovic or Nadal would power Sampras or Borg off the court, really. Which is kind of sad, you know. We don't like to think of it that way. We have this kind of nostalgia for, I don't know, Pele, but clearly, you know, even if you take the stats out of the equation, you know, Ronaldo, Messi are two of the best players of all time because football is just so much better now than it used to be in terms of the score.
Yeah.
Maybe not in terms of how much we enjoy it, but in terms of, you know, how fast the players can run and how far they can pass. And
is that the thing with, is it when you talk about greatest of all time, are you simply talking about the player who would win the Grand Slam of all the players, all the great players in history playing together, or is greatest a kind of question of like what they've achieved contextually and in what barriers they broke down and what, you know, what they pioneered and when they were the first people to do certain seemingly impossible things? I don't know. It just seems the idea of the greatest of all time is very different from the idea of the best of all time. There's a reason we're talking goat, not boat. No?
Yeah. I mean, goat sounds better, arguably, but
yeah, but it only sounds better because everyone, all these children talk about goat all the time when they, you know, they've popularized the term, but it could very easily have been boat.
Yeah, no, I think definitely like context matters, and you know, being a trailblazer and dominating
Billie Jean King could be the goat of the women's tour, rather if, you know, if not the boat,
because of how important she's been to the tour itself.
Yeah, I'm making an argument for a sort of question of whether great means best.
I think there's two ways of looking at it, right? Like, I think you could just say that it's kind of a tiebreaker in the sense that Serena would definitely beat Steffi Graf, and because she's already ahead of her on titles, then we kind of, the whole recency bias is not actually bias. Recent players are better than players from long ago because they were able to learn from, you know, stand on the shoulders of giants kind of thing. But again, what I came down to when I was picking Federer over the other two is that I just enjoy Federer more. And I think Serena has been this kind of feminist icon. She's also you know, the most successful player of all time as a black woman in a sport which has been very white, which I think also gives her the edge, you know, overcoming tough childhood, et cetera, et cetera. There's also kind of the narrative of her and Venus. You know, I think if the story kind of makes sense, then the whole greatness aspect kind of coalesces around it. Then the stats are just secondary, as used to back up the argument that you already were going to make anyway, because people were already discussing Nadal and Djokovic being contenders for greatest of all time, actually long before they were on the slam count that they are now. I think when Djokovic won all three, you know, Australian Open, Wimbledon, and US Open 2011 against like prime Fed and prime Nadal, people were already saying, wow, this guy could be like greatest of all time. But at that point, he only had four majors.
Well, it's interesting because in 2012, the Tennis Channel did a kind of massive ranking of the 100 greatest players of all time. And in that, Djokovic is way down. He actually had five Grand Slams in 2012. He's way down in 40th. I mean, so, and Federer, you know, had 16, was, you know, behind Laver and behind, well, he wasn't behind Nadal at the time, but he was behind lots of female tennis players, and they ranked him first. And it's, there's certainly a sense that Federer has aesthetically changed the game in a way that no other player has.
But has Serena done that? I mean, Serena is, disregarding the whole kind of sportsmanship discussion, I mean, Serena is just a power player. She just serves harder and hits harder than anyone else.
Look, if she was a man, you'd be calling her a serve bot.
Yeah, she is kind of a serve bot. I mean, her serve is just much more powerful than any other women's player at the moment. Like I said, it's hard to remember what Steffi Graf playing was like. She basically just sliced every backhand and then had a very good, very kind of precise and quite powerful forehand. But neither her serve nor her return would be particularly notable in today's game, I think.
I would love for some Steffi Graf stands to write into the show and let us know why Steffi Graf is the GOAT. But I think in the meantime, we have settled this argument. We're actually the first people to ever say it out loud that we think probably Roger Federer is the greatest of all time.
So is Serena. And what about between those two? The final battle.
Yeah, I think we probably both would say that Federer is somehow greater because of, I guess, the strength of the men's game in his era, which I think is probably an unprecedented. And also just because he is an unusual tennis player in the way he plays. And it's almost unique. Whereas, you know, Serena Williams plays like a lot of very good men's players. And that's unusual in the women's tour, but it's not unusual in tennis, perhaps?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think the extra two or three titles that Serena has don't compensate for the fact that Federer had to contend against two of the other greatest of all time, and Serena kind of had a decade in which no strong contender emerged. And then Federer's, not something we haven't fully addressed. We kind of refer to his aesthetic appeal, but you know, he's one of the most versatile players I think in the game, both his forehand and his net game and these kind of weird trick shots that he's executed time and time again. He's kind of, you know, what Kyrgios wishes he could be, except that he's also won 20 majors.
Well, we almost went a whole podcast without mentioning Nick Kyrgios, the most over discussed player of all time.
Most over discussed player of all time, Mopot.
Yeah, the Mapote. Well, thanks, Pavel, for joining all the way from Munich. And we'll be back again answering the next in our series of big questions in tennis.